and gentlemen, this is People's Question Time. I'm your host, Roderick Gates. I'll begin with 10, maybe 15 minutes reviewing some of the latest events today from Melbourne to Washington. Afterwards, I invite you listeners to call us on our phone-in numbers to speak on what issues I've mentioned or others you want to speak about. The numbers are available on the BBS radio website. In Jerusalem, there has been a new collection of clashes at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount compound, between stone-throwing Muslim worshippers and Israeli police who entered the holy site because of excavation that the Muslims believe are being used to undermine the foundations of the mosque. And there is optimism now on the streets in Mecca because of a deal reached between Fatah and Hamas in the pursuit of a new coalition national unity government, which could bring an end to that very sad squabble. There is a suspect charged over a kidnap plot in the UK. British police have charged a man arrested in Birmingham in connection with an alleged Iraq-style kidnap and beheading plot, along with four other men. He is also charged with supplying equipment and funding for a jihadist terrorist act. And the UN has now decided to give more time to Serbia on Kosovo talks, following the UN proposal of autonomy and near statehood for Kosovo. Following UN envoy Maruti Afisari's report on the future status of Kosovo, the UN has granted Belgrade more time to prepare for a final round of talks before new developments are to take place. And the EU seeks to jail environmental criminals. Brussels has adopted a proposal to unify sanctions against major polluters. And those found guilty of breaches could face heavy fines or even jail sentences. And there are, at least in France today, more than 20% of public officials are now on strike. Teachers, tax collectors, railway workers and other public servants have gone on strike in protest at job losses and to demand higher pay. And French schools are now in a fight about creationism. I never thought I'd hear this occurring in France. In early February this month, hundreds of French teachers received copies of a creationist book by a Turkish Muslim fundamentalist scholar. It struck a nerve in the country where state and religion are so clearly separated, except maybe Catholic private schools, which are subsidized by the French government. And in Germany, a band Meinhof, while old wounds are reopening there. The case of the Bander Meinhof gang, the extreme left-wing terrorist group responsible for a series of murders in the 1970s, is back in the spotlight in Germany. And opinion is, well, supposedly divided on whether its members should ever be released. And police have been probed in Italy over deaths that have sparked the recent soccer riot. Two French police officers have been placed under formal investigation over the death of two teenagers in a Paris suburb that has set off the weeks of rioting of late 2005. And there is the question being raised in, well, how is holding back the Harare murder trial because of lack of wide-ranging parameters to investigate the murder. And a French diplomat in the Ivory Coast was killed by unidentified attackers last night in the Ivory Coast, and there is an immediate investigation launching on there. And a huge new campaign against AIDS is thankfully at last now being launched. Solidarity AIDS has launched a fresh campaign to fight the disease in Africa, and maybe expanding beyond, depending on their success and external support. They are seeking to raise 1 million euros this year to help the victims get treatment. In the Democratic Congo's political instability has at least temporarily been brought to an end because after 12 weeks, President Joseph Kabila has won elections. A new government was announced on Monday in the DRC. A new government has a difficult task ahead, of course, as clashes killed dozens recently, just before and as well as entering into the elections. And in Uganda, dreams have come true as kids play Baka. The United Nations children body UNICEF is looking to reach out to vulnerable children in Uganda through football. And that meant a dream come true for a team of youngsters who headed to Spain to play for Barcelona in the under-17s. And there are hopes now of breakthroughs in nuclear talks with North Korea because the six nation talks in Beijing have produced a concession that North Korea might eventually give up WMDs in return for energy aid. Energy aid is their main domestic issue now, apart from political repression. And there is a film now showing Tibetan refugees fleeing from the PRC. A human rights group claims Chinese authorities have shot at, arrested and tortured a group of Tibetan refugees who now become celebrities overnight. The alleged incident was filmed by a Western mountaineer. And there is violence in Afghanistan, just on Pakistan's border, in regards to poppy harvesting. The Afghan police, or at least the ones who are now under investigation, opened fire on a region close to the Pakistani border after unhappy farmers turned violent to protect their crops of opium, which are now being subjected to a wipeout campaign by the Afghan colonial government. And there are new exposures about child trafficking in Asia. A picture taken by undercover police in Kyrgyzstan have shown the harsh realities behind child trafficking. According to the UN, over 1 million children around the world are trafficked every year, mainly for cheap labor or sexual exploitation. Now, this is a helpful development and at least indicates that people are taking notice of this issue. I think I've finished my quick interview, ladies and gentlemen. And for those of you who are interested in calling in, the toll number is 877-876-5227 for the US. For Canada, it's 48-810-8322. And the direct international number is 530-876-3222. They're also on the PBS radio website if you haven't got your pen ready. On a side issue, I recently came across an American conservative paper, the American Conservative, on April 24, 2006 edition by James Brovard, that goes through the record of the subverted Iraqi election in 2004. Although, I'm quoting, though Bush perennially invokes spreading democracy to justify the invasion of Iraq, suppressing democracy was one of the first orders of business for the U.S. occupation authorities. 3.5 months after the fall of Baghdad, military commanders ordered a halt to local elections and self-rule in provincial cities and towns across Iraq, choosing instead to install their own hand-picked mayors and administrators, many of whom are former Iraqi military leaders, the Washington Post reported. Many Iraqis were outraged to see Saddam's former henchmen placed back in power over them. U.S. Viceroy Paul Bremer feared that the chaos that followed Saddam's fall would not be conducive to electing positive thinkers. He had to say that in a post-war situation like this, you start holding elections, people who are rejectionists tend to win, and the U.S. military presence would likely be one of the first things freely elected Iraqis would have rejected. The early suppression of popular government helped turn many Iraqis against the U.S. occupation. But as Noah Feldman, the coalition provisional authority's law advisor, explained in November 2003, if you move too fast, the wrong people could get elected. The repeated delays of elections were partly the result of the Bush administration's lack of enthusiasm for Iraqi self-rule, as well as its fear that pro-Iran Shiites would win an honest election. The Bush administration only agreed to hold elections after the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, as you might recall, the most powerful religious leader in Iraq, sent his followers into the streets to demand an opportunity to vote. After it quickly became clear that pro-American parties would be clobbered, Bush authorized covert aid to Iraqi parties and politicians. However, when senior members of Congress were briefed on the plan, they vehemently objected. Bush cancelled the formal plan but delivered covert aid anyway, using back channels and undercover operators that remind you almost of how the mafia were financed. All this just so that all the Iran-Contra scandal, as it was exposed in the 80s, all this just to keep the secret from Congress as well as the American public. Seymour Hersh reported in the New York, in the New Yorker in 2005, mid-2005, the White House promulgated a highly classified presidential finding authorization for the CIA to provide money and other support covertly to political candidates in certain countries who, in the administration's view, were seeking to spread democracy. The elections that were eventually held on January 30, 2005, had more in common with a Soviet-era Eastern Bloc election than with a New England town meeting. In the weeks before the vote, the U.S. military carried out Operation Founding Fathers. In Samarra, the Get Up and Vote message was broadcast from loudspeakers. At the same time, American troops, leaping out of Bradley fighting vehicles, raided and searched people's homes. A U.S. military convoy rolled through Mosul neighborhoods shortly after sunrise on Election Day, with speakers blaring messages urging everyone to vote, USA reported. The soldiers also passed out thousands of sample ballots. Karina Pirelli, the top U.N. election official, condemned the role of U.S. troops being used in the election. Bush proclaimed on the day of the vote that the elections were a resounding success and that the world is hearing the voice of freedom from the center of the Middle East. Well, the American media largely parroted the official line, but pro-U.S. candidates were crushed, absolutely wiped out of the polls as pro-Iranian parties took the prize, defining democracy down in Bush's meddling in foreign affairs undercuts his set of principles. As James Bullard Goodrell. For those of you still listening, and wish to call in, the toll-free number is 877-876-5227 for the US. And for Canada, 4810-8322. The direct international number is 530-876-3222. Financial speculators continue to have their day in a world mostly run by money, and their opposition to economic growth is largely unknown. The consensus in elite sectors from the US to Zambia is strong economic growth, while the bottom line is that economic growth in itself is not the main aim. See, for example, there's Louis Ishtel's Who Rules? It's the Bond Market Stupid in the International Herald Tribune in June of 1994 in the finance section. Favor a weak economy, they ask. Who would do that? Enter that mysterious and slightly sinister entity, the bond market, the preeminent force in the economy today. More than any other group, the bond market determines how many Americans will have jobs. whether the job holders will earn enough to afford a house or a car, or whether a factory might have to lay off workers. In sum, the American economy is governed by the bond market, a loose confederation of wealthy Americans, bankers, financiers, money managers, rich foreigners, executives of life insurance companies, presidents of universities and non-profit foundations, retirees and people who once kept their money in passbooks, saving accounts, or under a bed, and now buy shares in mutual funds. While some would recoil at being called enemies of economic growth, the fact is that the Confederation has ruled in recent months that the economy should lose strength, not gain it. The bond market's members speak in a monologue, and the messages contract the economy, a U.S. official has said. Mr. Clinton's administration does not aggressively challenge the bond market's preference for subdued economic growth. Keith Bradshaw has covered this issue as well. In U.S. shift stance and efforts to slow economic growth, on the 8th of May 1994 in the New York Times, after a year and a half, I'm quoting, of seeking faster economic growth, the Clinton administration has now reluctantly changed course, putting the stability of financial markets ahead of rapid economic expansion. The shift is in keeping with Mr. Clinton's political goal of positioning himself as a Democrat who is not feared on Wall Street. Antonio Sharp has, and Peter John also, covered the issue in Sharp Decline in U.S. Jobless Rate Unsettles Bonds in the Financial Times in London on the 4th of June of 1994. James Cooper and Kathleen Madigan in Just What the Doctor Ordered, Slower Growth in Business Week, also in June 1994. And Mark Memot in Jobless Rate Increase Seen as Good News in USA Today of May 1989. For the Wall Street Journal article, Douglas R. Sonoff and Constance Mitchell discuss this in The Vigilantes, World's Bond Buyers Gain Huge Influence Over U.S. Physical Plans in the Wall Street Journal in late 1992. Here's what they had to say. They aren't elected, and you may not know any of them. Many are citizens of other countries, but big bond investors around the world may now hold unprecedented power, perhaps even a veto, over U.S. economic policy. Bill Clinton got a taste of that power in the past 4 weeks. Bondholders, increasingly anticipating the Arkansas Democrats' victory in the presidential race, pushed down prices of U.S. Treasury bonds and thus pushed up long-term interest rates to about 7.7% from 7.3% a month ago. It was the bond market's way of warning Mr. Clinton that as the new president, he will long be on probation, with his every move instantaneously scrutinized. Since the election, bond prices have slipped only slightly. If Clinton proposes big spending programs or policies that accelerate inflation, a bondholder's deepest fear, the reaction could be swift and painful. If thousands of investors worldwide dump U.S. Treasury bonds, they could drive up long-term investment rates, which move inversely to bond prices, hobble America's economic growth, and even plunge the nation back into recession. With the U.S. government's seemingly relentless borrowing, both Wall Street and Washington increasingly viewed the bond market as a potent force that the U.S. officials have to take into account. Even modest stimulatory proposals could prove self-destructive. Based on campaign promises and economists' projections, Mr. Clinton seems to be proposing changes in government spending and taxation that will result in a net $20 billion increase in the fiscal 1994 budget deficit, though the president-elect himself says there won't be any net increase in the deficit. If bond investors react with even a modest dose of anxiety, that sends long-term rates up just 1 percentage point. The deficit would increase another $20 billion, effectively doubling the to $40 billion the program's costs, as estimated by outside economists. While this has been described more generally as the establishment of a virtual Senate, if governments don't do what business says, then there'll be a vote in the other Senate, a Senate that isn't elected and is barely visible. And there has been, on a side note, actual studies done on the costs of empire and imperialism. On the number one study, at least as far as I can see, on the cost and profitability of the British Empire, John Strachey's book, The End of Empire, published in 1959, especially chapters 10 to 12, is one of the earliest investigations of this, shows a kind of balance. It kind of balances out. It's literally 50-50. There's barely any real surplus of benefits, and of course the benefits do not flow to ordinary people. For the ordinary British soldier dying in the mountains of British Afghanistan, obviously it was terrible, but for British financiers in London, it was the glorious years, the golden times. The financial times that continues its deceit as usual in regards to Adam Smith. In reading an online edition of the Financial Times, I found another elite omission about Adam Smith and the mystifications of his writings. I'm quoting, nearly 230 years ago, Adam Smith reported the benefits of the division of labor using the example of pin making. Allenbach neglects other details of Smith's writings. And here's what I sent to the Financial Times in response. He's pre-capitalist, a figure of the Enlightenment, what we would call capitalism he despised. A people read snippets of Adam Smith, the few phrases that are taught in school. Everybody reads the first paragraph of The Wealth of Nations, where he talks about how wonderful the division of labor is. But not everybody goes down to that point hundreds of pages later, where it says that the division of labor will destroy human beings and turn people into creatures as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human to be. And therefore, any civilized society, the government is going to have to intervene in the economy to prevent the division of labor from proceeding to its limits. He did give an argument for markets, but regulated markets, in the argument of under conditions of perfect liberty, markets will eventually lead to perfect equality. That's the argument for them. Not that they're most efficient and will benefit business investment climates. That's the argument. Because he thought that equality of condition, not just opportunity or business operations, is what you should aim at as a society, not as an individual. It goes on and on. He gave a devastating critique of what we would call North-South policies or imperial policies. He was talking about Britain in its occupation of India. He bitterly denounced British occupation policies carried out in India. He also made remarks which ought to be truisms about the way states work. He pointed out that it is totally senseless to talk about a nation and what we would nowadays call the national interest, or American interests abroad, or British interests in the Middle East, etc. He simply observed in passing, because it's a truism, because it's so obvious, that in Britain, which is what he's discussing, and it was the most democratic society of the day at the time, the principal architects of policy are the merchants and manufacturers who ensure that their interests are most peculiarly attended to, no matter what the effect on others, including the people of England, who, he argued, suffered from their policies. He didn't have the data to prove it at the time, but he was probably right. When Charles Dickens wasn't just writing fiction books, he was also, in many ways, reflecting on contemporary Britain at the time. This truism was, a century later, defined by Karl Marx as class analysis, and class consciousness, but you don't have to go to the Communist Manifesto or Das Kapital to find it. It's very explicit in Adam Smith, though we don't denounce him. It's so obvious that any 10-year-old could see it. So he didn't make a big point of it, nor did he campaign in a book which is about the expansion and investigation of the wealth of nations, not markets and capitalism. He mentioned it, but that's correct. If you read through his work, he's intelligent. His person is from the Enlightenment. Well, if you're an Enlightenment figure, obviously anti-capitalist. His driving motive was that there is an assumption that people are guided by sympathy and feelings of solidarity and the need for control of their own work, I'm quoting, like many other Enlightenment and early Romantic figures. He's part of that period, the Scottish Enlightenment, its own sort of separate Enlightenment phase. The version of him that's given today is a total perversion, if you take his writing seriously, all of it, not just certain parts. But one does not have to do an elaborate research project to find all this out in the way that's treated, and that's very interesting. I take the University of Chicago, the huge bastion of free market economics, of which the now late Milton Friedman arose from. It publishes bicentennial editions of this great right-wing hero, a scholarly edition with all the footnotes and introduction by Nobel Prize winner George Stilger, a huge index, very scholarly style. Now that's the one one can use to analyze. It's the best edition. The scholarly framework was very interesting, including Stilger's introduction. It's likely he's never opened The Wealth of Nations. He's never read it in his life. Just about everything he said about the book was completely false. Adam Smith is very well known for his advocacy of the division of labor. Yes, that's true. However, take a look at the division of labor chapter, and there are lots of things listed. But there's one missing, namely his denunciation of the division of labor, the one I just cited. That's somehow missing from the index. It goes on and on like this. I wouldn't call it research because it's 10 minutes work, but if you look at the scholarship, then it's interesting. I'll be clear about this. There is good Adam Smith scholarship. If you look at the serious Smith scholarship, nothing I'm saying is any surprise to anyone. How could it be? You open the book and it's there. On the other hand, if you look at a myth conjured up at Adam Smith, well, that's the only one you usually get. The discrepancy between that and reality is enormous. This is true of classical liberalism in general. The founders of classical liberalism, people like Adam Smith, Wilhelm von Humboldt, was one of the great exponents of classical liberalism, and it inspired John Stuart Mill. There's a name you should find familiar, listeners. They were what we would call anarchists, or at least that is the way one can only read them without feeling guilty. For example, Humboldt, like Smith, says, consider a craftsman who builds something beautiful. Humboldt says, if he does it under external coercion, though, like wages, we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. On the other hand, if he does it over his own free creative expression of himself, under free will, but not under external coercion of wage labor, then we also admire what he is because he's a human being. He said that any decent socioeconomic system will be based on the assumption that people have the freedom to inquire and create. Since that's the fundamental nature of humans, in free association with others, but not under external constraints and coercion. And that's the same when you read Thomas Jefferson as an even more familiar figure, particularly to North American listeners. He lived half a century later, so he saw how state capitalism developed, and he despised it, something you don't hear very much. He said, I'm quoting, it's going to lead to a form of absolutism worse than the one we defended ourselves against. He's referring to the War of Independence. In fact, if you run through this whole period, you see a very clear, sharp critique of what we would later call state capitalism, and certainly of the 20th century version of it. which is designed to destroy individual and even entrepreneurial initiative. There's a side current here, which is rarely looked at, but which is also quite enlightening. That's the working class literature of the 19th century. They didn't read Adam Smith and Wilhelm von Humboldt, but they're saying the same things. We're talking about women who work in factories, factory girls, just as the US was industrializing. Working people running ran their own newspapers alongside working on the treadmill. It's the same kind of critique. There was a real battle fought by working people in Britain and the US, the major industrial powers at the time, to defend themselves against what they called the degradation and oppression and violence of the industrial capitalist system, which was not only dehumanizing them, but even radically reducing their intellectual and physical levels. So you go back to the mid-19th century, these so-called factory girls in Massachusetts mills or the cotton mills of Birmingham. Well, they were reading contemporary literature. They recognized the point of the system was to turn them into tools, machines who would just produce and produce, degraded, kicked around, and so on. And they fought against it bitterly, even went on strikes, violated the Combination Acts of the 18th and 19th centuries in the UK. The other part of the story is the development of corporations, which is an interesting story in itself. Adam Smith didn't say much about them because they hadn't really emerged yet, but he did criticize the early stages of them. Jefferson lived long enough to see the beginnings, and he was very strongly opposed to him. But the development of corporations really took place in the early 20th century and very late in the 19th century. Originally, corporations existed as a public service. People would get together, build a bridge, and they would be incorporated for that purpose by the state. They built a bridge, and that's it. It was dissolved immediately afterwards. They were supposed to have a public interest function and not a private function. We'll go back to the 1870s, states were removing corporate charters. They were granted by the state. They weren't permanent, and they were only meant to exist temporarily. They were removing corporate charters because they weren't as punishment for corporations that weren't serving a public function. So if a modern-day CEO plundered his company, sacked everyone, then made a run for the Bahamas, well, the corporation will be dissolved and he will be chased to his death. Well, that's the Middle Ages for you. Harsh times generally, but they took a pretty harsh line in late 18th and 19th centuries against what are nowadays corporate crooks. Well, but then they were removing corporate charters because they weren't serving these public functions. But then you get into the period of the trusts, monopolies, and various efforts to consolidate economic power that were beginning to be made in the late 19th century. It's interesting to look at the literature. The history books are sometimes very open about it. The courts didn't really accept it. There were hints about it. It wasn't until the early 20th century, I'm not talking about far back in history, that courts and lawyers designed a new socioeconomic system. It was never done by legislation in the British Parliament or the US Congress, etc. It was done by courts, by judicial activism, and the power they could exercise over individual states. New Jersey was the first American state to offer corporations any right they wanted. Of course, all the capital in the country immediately flowed to New Jersey for the obvious reasons. And then the other states had to do the same thing just to defend themselves or be wiped out economically. It's kind of a small-scale globalization. Then the courts, the corporate lawyers came along, created a huge new body of judicial doctrine which gave corporations authority and power that they'd never had before. If you look at the background, it's the same that led to fascism and Bolshevism. A lot of it supported by people in Western establishments that called themselves progressives for these reasons. They said individual rights are gone. We are in a period of corporatization of power, consolidation, and centralization. That's supposed to be good if you're progressive, like a Marxist-Leninist. Out of that the same background came three other major things: fascism, Bolshevism, and corporate tyranny. They all grew out of the same, more or less, Argalian roots. It's very recent. We think of corporations as immutable, but they were designed. They were originally very temporary. It was a conscious decision which worked, as Adam Smith said, the principal architects of policy, consolidate state power and use it for their interests. It was certainly not popular will and authorized. It's basically court judicial activism, which created a form of private tyranny. That's what corporations are, unaccountable private tyrannies. Princetons from Washington to Cape Hope. These are major parts of the modern 20th century. The classical liberals would be horrified. They didn't even imagine, say, that this kind of thing would develop if Democrats aren't successful in the abolition of feudalism. We have to act quickly. The small things that they saw, they were already horrified about, denounced them on the spot. But this would totally scandalize Adam Smith and Thomas Jefferson, and we would take their concerns seriously as they voiced them if we took these figures seriously. And there are huge efforts to go into making people, to borrow Adam Smith's phrase, as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human to be. A lot of the educational system is designed for that. Education is a system of ignorance. It's a system of imposed ignorance, to put it bluntly. It's designed to only teach you basically obedience and passivity from childhood. A lot of it is designed to prevent people from being independent and creative. If you're independent mind in school, you'll get in trouble for contradicting the teacher and questioning the authority of the textbook. You'll be given a detention. That's not the trait that's preferred or cultivated. When people live through all this stuff, plus corporate propaganda, excessive television, plus the press and the whole mass and deluge of ideological distortion, they ask questions that, from another point of view, are completely reasonable. For listeners who just joined us, call-ins are still welcome. The toll-free number is 877-876, the 5227 in the U.S. The Canada, it's 4810-8322. The direct international number is 530-876-3222. A related issue I will raise as a response to the British Prime Minister's Lord Mayor's banquet speech on the 13th of November of last year, in which the British Prime Minister once more propagated obvious untruths. I note the UK media didn't burn him for a very deceitful speech. In reference to Islamic fundamentalist terrorism groups, he said, "In this century, a new and unconventional enemy has appeared." Well, that's false. They emerged in 1979 in the last century, brought together by Britain and the US to fight in Afghanistan. I suppose Blair expects us to think Hezbollah is new. Well, it is not new. He both contradicts himself and misleads us about public knowledge of these fundamentalists by saying it was present for years but little noticed by us before 9/11. In a sense, no one took notice of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing attempt by similar jihadists. Since 9/11, it has cast its shadow over the Western world. Well, that's an interesting quote from Blair, because it always had. Afghans were immediately angry at the US and the UK for bringing in madmen to fight the Russians, the same as people in the rest of the world, including the West. Interestingly, again, Blair talks about terrorism as if the victims are military as opposed to civilian. The bomb which killed British forces in Iraq yesterday was a cruel and wicked reminder that this terrorism is dedicated. He also tells outright lies about the government of Iraq as now elected, as if Mubarak in Egypt was elected. The Kurds were the biggest opponents, not jihadis, and opposed U.S. subversion. When the Iraqi, I'm quoting, national election approached, al-Hakim was able to mobilize and organize under his wing scattered Shiite political groups into what he called the United Iraqi Alliances. The U.S. realized his attempt and attempted to thwart his advance. They employed their own candidate, Ayed Alawi, the current prime minister. The Saudis and Kuwaitis backed up Alawi's party through the media and with hundreds of millions of dollars. To the dismay of the United States, however, Alawi's party came in a distant second as al-Hakim's alliance won by a landslide. Blair refused to acknowledge, and still does, the UK as one of other occupying powers. Do not countenance the myth, he said, that is, it is a protest about the so-called occupation of Basra by British forces. He was warned in public and private, I'm quoting, the 30 January election may succeed in enhancing the legitimacy of the Iraq occupation, but it will fail to accurately reflect the will of the Iraqi people. Bringing the country together, quiet dissent or channel dissent along avenues of peaceful political compromise. He continued on saying, the terrorists know the whole purpose of the operation we are conducting with the Iraqi forces is to allow Iraqis to take charge. Well, that is not the view of the Iraqi people, actually. Asked whether they view the coalition as liberators or occupiers, 71% of all respondents say occupiers. The PM praises the UK occupying forces. We should reflect on the quite humbling courage of the British Armed Forces. They are remarkable people, making an extraordinary sacrifice. They have our admiration. Iraq. Thank you, ladies. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We just got cut off. Terribly sorry. As I was saying just before the interruption, the British Prime Minister then proceeded to praise the UK occupying forces, who were ultimately, surely, it is a matter of what the Iraqis have to say. I'm quoting, nearly 58% say the soldiers conduct themselves badly or very badly, and report a different attitude of the UK military treatment of them. And more than 60% say the troops show disrespect for Iraqi people in searches of their homes. And 42% say US forces have shown disrespect towards mosques. And 46% say the soldiers show a lack of respect for Iraqi women. And I'm sure that doesn't just mean verbal insults. Occupying troops recognize the Iraqi viewpoint. I can see their point of view, says Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Leffy, his 20-year-old of Orange, California. If anyone walked up on my street, I'd be pissed too. Now, Blair no doubt feels that he explains the facts when asserting, in Iraq, the pressure from such terrorism has changed the nature of the battle. Its purpose is now plain, to provoke civil war. But that's not what the record shows. Russia Namir, 20, a computer science major at Baghdad University, it tells a far different story. The war was not worth it. It was without any reason except to control the oil, she says. We don't want your help. But the hostility reflected in the poll is a message to the troops. And understand, says Marine Lance Corporal Monks. They don't want us here, he says. They want to rebuild their own country. We're trying to Americanize their life. You can't buy love. Up to 65% in another study of Iraqi citizens support attacks on foreign occupying troops. Iraqis generally prefer to kill UK and other troops, not express admiration for them. Blair goes on to claim Iran has been confronted over its nuclear weapons ambitions. Well, no evidence has been provided of any ambitions, only energy generation. Even worse is that Blair's partners in Washington have been caught lying about the nuclear program. The UN nuclear watchdog has protested to the US government a report on Iran's nuclear program, calling it erroneous and misleading. Blair's friends in Washington are so lacking in credibility and evidence about an Iranian nuclear weapons program, they have to lie about it. The nuclear energy generation ambitions is something I'm sure the Prime Minister is familiar with. He shares them, as well as expanding the UK nuclear arsenal in violation of the non-proliferation treaty. Blair isn't above telling lies about Iran either, claiming the statements of its president, such as wiping Israel from the face of the earth, are causing alarm, even in Iran. There were no such statements. He actually said the regime occupying Jerusalem must vanish from the page of time, except in the mind of some kind of jingoist in a parallel universe. Blair goes on to even more extraordinary lengths to lie again. The most extreme elements of Hamas in Palestine, Hezbollah in the Lebanon, Shia militia in Iraq. That way they put obstacles in the path of peace, paint us as they did of the Israeli-Lebanon conflict as the aggressors. In the sense, Israel didn't invade Lebanon in 1982 in a war of aggression. The 1967 war wasn't an act of aggression, and the invasion of Iraq was provoked somehow, like missiles flying from Iraq to California. I talk about rewriting history, not just about the Labour Party, but wars in the Middle East. He also redraws the map of Europe by saying, in passing, I put Britain at the center of Europe. No doubt Atlas book publishers will ignore that ludicrous claim. And maybe Switzerland and Liechtenstein and Austria could be described as the center of Europe, but not Britain, not if we take facts seriously. He also claims global terrorism is a problem Britain wants solving. Well, that's quite amusing. Jason Burke wrote probably the best book on radical Islam, and he has more to inform us than Blair ever could. I'm quoting, "The Islamic militants see their struggle as a defensive one. They believe that they are resisting a tradition of belligerence and aggression by the West that goes back to the Crusades. Unfortunately, attacking, however justifiably or not, two Islamic nations in the space of 2 years, one of which is the cultural heart of many Islamic and many Muslims and Arabs' cultural identity, that clearly is going to provide evidence for those who believe in that worldview. The point here is that if you accept that bin Laden and his close aides are not solely responsible for global terrorism, and that far more profound and widespread factors are at work involving ideology, world views, and a way of seeing international relations, relations between the West and Islam, and so forth, then though you may have halted a potential threat, you've created something that's far more dangerous by doing so." As Burke reviews, Clinton's 1998 bombings of Sudan and Afghanistan created bin Laden as a symbol, forged close relations between him and the Taliban, and led to a sharp increase in support and recruitment financing for Al-Qaeda, which until then was virtually unknown. The next major contribution to the growth of Al-Qaeda and the prominence of bin Laden was Bush's bombing of Afghanistan following September 11, undertaken without credible pretext, as was later quietly conceded. As a result, bin Laden's message, I'm quoting, spread among tens of millions of people, particularly the young and angry around the world, Burke wrote, reviewing the increase in jihadist terror and the creation of a whole new cadre of terrorists enlisted in what they see as a cosmic struggle between good and evil, a vision shared by bin Laden of Bush. As noted, the invasion of Iraq had the same effect. Burke concludes that every use of force is another small victory for bin Laden, who is winning whether he lives war dies. Burke's assessment is widely shared by many analysts, including former heads of the Israeli intelligence and the General Security Services. We can help the vanguard mobilize this reservoir of support by violence, or can address the myriad grievances, many legitimate, that are the root causes of modern Islamic militancy that can significantly reduce the threat of terror and should be undertaken independently of this goal. Wars of aggression in Arab Muslim lands are clearly not a solution to the problem. They are an element the problem feeds on. Blair puts on his fortune teller cape to explain, without America, Kosovo could not have been attempted. Without Kosovo, Milosevic might still be running Serbia. In a sense, the Falklands needed US participation and otherwise wouldn't have happened. And that Milosevic would never have been brought down by his own people, which he was eventually, like many other brutal monsters installed and supported by the UK and US. And the rogues' gallery is long. Ceausescu, Suharto, de Valier, Marcos, Hussein, the Shah of Iran, etc. He also told us that 9/11 would have changed any American president's foreign policy. I wasn't aware it changed. Maybe he thinks it is changed, but that's a fool's declaration. The U.S. was born out of wars of aggression against Native Americans. The Philippines, Russia, Angola, Libya, South Vietnam, and Cambodia. It had nothing to do with terrorist attacks in the U.S. That is a fact, to use Tony Blair's phrase. I knew this attack wasn't aimed at America per se, but America's leading representative of our values is an interesting assertion. He doesn't define America, nor his values he keeps talking about. On top of the fact, it's unsubstantiated. Asserting the benign economic and political development of China is pretty sweeping, as if sweatshops and labor repression is benign. The world is changing is another sweeping statement without evidence presented, so we can dismiss it. The vital life source of British power, influence, and weight in the new global community taking shape around us is another. What global community? There already is one, and repeatedly demonstrates opposition to what he and company pursue. From the Doha round to the occupation of Iraq, we can learn a great deal through inquiry and analysis, but sweeping statements like these are unhelpful, to use one of Blair's favorite phrases. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're just about to wrap up. For those of you who are interested in calling, I have phone numbers from the website.